Tongue twisting. Going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 119. I believe there's an amendment that meets the needs of those that have been working with the bill, and so we'll have staff introduce it. And
sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 119 had hearings on the 10th of February and the 2nd of April, at which time in April we heard that there were some concerns about disclosure of records, financial records, and Cheryl Pellegrini and Tim Martinez worked on the Dash 1 amendment, and both of them have seen it, or everybody's seen it, and everybody's okay with it, including counsel.
And I guess
and
we
this does have a subsequent referral to judiciary right now. My thoughts were that the last meeting you talked about.
Yeah, we can. We're on Senate Bill 119, Senator Brown. And we don't have anybody signed that, so no. I guess we can go right to a work session.
Sure.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 119 and go to a work session on Senate Bill 119. We have a Dash 1 amendment here that I would receive a motion on.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Carno.
I would move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 119.
Senator Carno moves the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 119. Is there further discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Burdick? Senator Carno?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Morstead?
Aye.
Senator Baker?
Aye. The motion carries, and Senator Burdick is excused. Now we'll take a motion on the bill.
Mr. Chair?
We want to do a remove a rescind a subsequent referral to judiciary, so I guess we've got to have at least
Mr. Chair, I would make a motion to remove the subsequent referral to judiciary.
Senator Carno moves to remove the subsequent referral to judiciary. Is there any further discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Carno.
I would move Senate Bill 119 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended.
Senator Carno moves Senate Bill 119 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objections? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Burdick? Senator Carno?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Morstead?
Aye.
Aye. Do we have a carrier? Do you wish to carry that, Senator Carno?
Sure.
In this case, Senator Carno will carry Senate Bill 119. Close the work session on Senate Bill 119 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 390.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 390 had a public hearing on the 31st of March. We didn't quite wrap that up, so we do have some people left over on the witness registration. The bill expands the types of organizations that may own or operate dental clinics or offices.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to go ahead and call the folks that didn't get a chance to testify. Some I don't see in the audience as yet, and they may show up. So I would ask Doug Barber and Russ House.
Chair Fisher, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Doug Barber, here today representing Willamette Dental Group. We have introduced the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 390, which you should have in your packets. That amendment is the one provision that came out of the work group, that interim work group that you heard about at your previous hearing, the one provision that only 7/8 of the work group agreed to. All of the dental organizations who were there agreed to it, the Board of Dentistry agreed to it, and the ODA, after initial agreement, then changed their mind and decided to oppose it. The amendment, as introduced, would allow non-dental ownership of a dental practice of up to 49%. That was modeled after the medical doctor provisions in Oregon law that allow non-doctors to own portions of their medical practices. After subsequent conversations with the Board of Dentistry, we would suggest, at their request, that we change that to 25%. Compromise, it's, the board is more comfortable at 25% non-dental ownership, and it still allows two things. From the board's perspective, I was talking with Joanne Bones, the executive director, this morning, who was down. There are hundreds of dentists in Oregon that already have non-dental owners on their practice, as part of their practice, even though it's illegal. The board does not want to try to enforce that provision, and so they want something in the law that will allow that to continue. The other reason to have non-dental ownership is to allow dentists access to capital, so like any business, so that they can expand their practice. And the Board of Dentistry has agreed that even if you had that non-dental ownership, it would not jeopardize patient protection or patient safety or the quality of the dental care. The dental care still has to be provided by a dentist, and they still have the tools that they need to ensure that. With me today is Russ House from Willamette Dental Group. Russ, along with other members of Willamette Dental, were part of the interim work group that helped come up with this Senate Bill 390 and the House Mirror Bill. It's in the House Health Committee. Russ?
Chair Fisher and members of the committee, I was a member of the task force that met at the request of Chair Fisher. Intercession. The reason that this task force was created was because the Attorney General's office had published an opinion that opined that several facets of the Dental Practice Act in Oregon were out of touch with current practice and, as interpreted, would make illegal some current practices in Oregon. The task force spent, 25 to 30 hours over seven sessions over a nine-month period of time working to fashion this bill that's before you to include the amendment with minority ownership. All of the issues were agreed to, as Mr. Barber has testified, except the minority non-dentist ownership. I will note that the Board of Trustees of the Oregon Dental Association favored 25% non-dentist ownership, but the House of Delegates of the ODA voted against it. Again, I would remind that without this amendment, this committee would be going against the recommendation of the Board of Dentistry. I think that there's some confusion about this, that this is somehow a managed care bill, that this part of it is a managed care piece. That is not true. The members of the group that were that are managed care organizations, Willamette Dental, Kaiser Dental, Northwest Dental, Capital Dental, have been operating in this state for years. You have two of the largest capitated staff model dental organizations in the United States in Oregon, and they've been here for 30 years in Kaiser and Willamette. So managed care organizations have worked a way to run their organizations by contract between the management practice management company and the provider professional corporation. This is not a managed care bill. This compromise was actually proposed by a Southern Oregon Network panel that has many dentists who are currently utilizing the benefits of the professional tax code of the Internal Revenue Service to obtain a lower tax rate. What it basically does is perfectly appropriate, and they should be using it if the law supported them to use it, is it permits them to phase in a tax rate on their income of their corporation rather than at a flat tax rate of 35%. The tax is 15% from zero to 50,000 in revenue, then increases to 25% from 50 to 75,000 and at 34% over over 100,000. This phase in helps them tax wise, and it's, again, it's not an Oregon tax that they're seeking to evade. It's a federal tax, and it's not evasion. It's taking advantage of the code that's been written by the Internal Revenue Service. We also think that this is an appropriate policy for Oregon. again, every member of the task force but the House of Delegates of the ODA supported this. Physicians have been for years at 49%. The 25% compromise is a fair, reasonable, and moderate compromise. Again, many states in the western United States and perhaps throughout the United States have what they call dental health maintenance organization statutes that permit 100% ownership of a dental practice by a non-dentist. This is not what is being proposed here. They do have them in other states for the very purpose of allowing for DHMOs, very much like HMOs on the medical side. What you have in Oregon now is the ability of Kaiser and Willamette and Capital to have practice management corporations that contract with the provider entity and conduct their enterprises in that manner. So again, this is not a managed care provision. Finally, there's been some allegations that this is somehow also going to impact quality of care. The Board of Dentistry is the ultimate arbiter of quality of care for dentists in the state of Oregon, and they support this bill with the amendment. Again, we think it has become controversial, unnecessarily so, and we ask that you move this bill with the amendment with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Yeah, I have a question here. I was under the impression that you were dealing in the House on, was it House Bill 2679?
2946.
2964.
We'll get it pretty soon.
20-something, yeah.
That is being amended to read 25%.
That's correct, and that's what we would recommend here as well.
So, in other words, we're still dealing with an amendment we don't have.
Yeah. Right.
Well, in that case, I'm going to go ahead and ask Barney Spate to come up and give his testimony, and then another group that's, I'm not sure what they are. Oh, I'm sorry.
Question.
Excuse me.
It's okay. It's okay. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Get blinders on here. Senator Brown.
Right. Well, Doug, I guess I have a couple of questions. One is, could you talk to me about why, if there's another bill dealing directly with this issue, why would we want to amend what I see as a compromise or a consensus piece of legislation, if there's another bill out there?
The Senate Bill 390 and House Bill 2964 are kind of mirror bills for about two pages. And then the only difference is the last section of 2964, which is the portion that deals with non-dental ownership, allowing that non-dental ownership, is not included in 390. And that's the provision that the amendment that we are proposing would add.
Okay.
To give the committee some background, this is a bill that I drafted in 2001 session, basically, that dealt with the death of a dentist unexpectedly, where his family or his spouse or his estate was left with no possible way of maximizing the benefits of that estate for his heirs, because they immediately would have to go somewhere. They could not hire a dentist to come in. And that came from a situation where my own personal family dentist, who was a family friend and I'd gone to school with the members of his family and stuff, died suddenly up here in Portland doing blackberry bushes in the spring for his mom and dad. And their dental clinic was in their house. His wife was the assistant. The house was too big for her to continue to maintain. Their garage or carport area for their house was their parking lot. Every single thing she had was tied up with the ability to practice. She had to immediately go out and get the patients that they had scheduled for. This happened on a Sunday, so she had to get the Monday patients stopped off, and the rest of the patients that were lined up off to friends around town had absolutely nothing to sell. Her house was suspect then because it couldn't be sold just as a normal house. It wasn't built right for anybody who didn't wish to run a business out of the house, and her whole entire life was absolutely thrown into a tailspin, and it didn't make any sense that she shouldn't have a right to have a dentist come in or to get a person that was looking to move from somewhere else here to Oregon or something to be able to come in and run that practice so that she would have something to make a profitable sale or even to sell it to a dentist that she could hire to come in and get a start. And so that's what I did. Then it got all compounded and compounded because all these folks came in wanting amendments on it. And I tried to get it through, and it wound up getting stalled and didn't get through. So that's when I insisted on getting some kind of a study group here, and they've come back, and now here we're sitting here 2 years later under the same situation. And my inclination is to pass this and let this stay free of the argument. However, if I have the support, I'm not unwilling to go ahead and amend this with the 25% and send it over, because I do support that issue also. But I want to get this thing through this session, and I'm going to put every bit of pressure I can on to get these spouses or these inheritance issues answered here, because it's absolutely totally unfair to somebody not to be able to protect their life's work.
Okay. Can I ask two more questions?
Right ahead.
And maybe it's for Doug and maybe for committee staff. I think I've heard through this entire conversation that medical doctors can own up to, have non-doctors own up to 49% of their practices. But people said because of there are differences in the health care provisions in the medical community that would make that there are not the protections here for the dental patients that there are for the medical patients.
Yeah, I would like to answer that. I think what Jane Myers is referring to when that issue is brought up is the so-called Patient Bill of Rights that was passed in Oregon that does exclude dental for some aspects. Primarily the notion that a treatment review appellate right would be applicable to dental in cases in which most dental procedures are under $500. That was seen as being unnecessary. But the Department of Insurance, which we have our insurance license to be an insurance carrier in the state, and the Oregon Health Plan also in a similar way, conduct the same kind of protections. There are rights to make complaints, and then rights that must be preserved for them to advance their complaint beyond the level of the initial treatment review by the practice. So it's a very highly regulated industry. You've got the Board of Dentistry that will investigate every written complaint against a dentist filed in this state, and is the ultimate arbiter of the standard of care in this state. You've got the Department of Insurance and the Department of Business and Consumer Affairs that regulate these areas, and dental patients do have these same basic rights that medical patients do as well.
And that's my understanding as well. The one thing I've heard in previous hearings on this was that there is no prompt pay provision for dental, but that's an issue between insurance companies and dentists. It has nothing to do with the quality of care that patients receive or who owns the dental practice. It's really a non-issue for the purposes of this amendment.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Barney.
So we're going to come back to the amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Barney Spate with Kaiser Permanente. I'm also testifying today on behalf of the Permanente Dental Group, with whom we work collaboratively in our dental program. Both the Kaiser Foundation Health Plan and the Permanente Dental Group were part of the work group that formed at Senator Fisher's request, and we were pleased to do that and commend the Senator for sponsoring the work. Senate Bill 390 is seven-eighths of everything that was talked about during the last year, and we endorse the bill as it's printed. You've heard that there is one-eighth of the work. There is not consensus. We have no position on that amendment, but support either 2964 or Senate Bill 390 in its seven-eighths approach, and are as anxious as Senator Fisher is to have at least some of these issues resolved permanently. It was a good work group, and everybody worked collaboratively on particularly the issues that were brought up because of the Attorney General's opinion, which called into question some of the models, both not-for-profit and community models, and also the Kaiser model as far as was it legal under the code. And the first seven-eighths of all of this bill resolves those issues. And I just want to let you know that we support it.
Thank you, Barney.
Thanks.
Yes, Senator Brown.
Mr. Chair, no offense, Barney, but that was not particularly helpful on this issue, so I want to put you on the spot. I'm getting, like, tons of phone calls from dentists and dental students. Why do they care so strongly about the ownership piece? Do you know? Do you have a sense of that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, I think the, and this is just a personal opinion and an observation, having worked through all of this and having watched the issues regarding what's known as minority ownership of the practice. It is basically, in my mind, a very deep-seated difference of opinion based on philosophy about how a professional dental practice should be constructed, and there are those that you've heard from previous witnesses that believe that minority ownership is a useful tool and can help a practice grow. It can also help reward employees, long-term non-dental employees, etc. There are others who feel this quite candidly is a slippery slope. And they feel very strongly about it, and it's that's my perception of, and some of these cases, if you've probably heard, we've been all around the barn relative to the size of the number, and it's really in many cases I've heard, I don't even think it's an issue of a number, it's an issue of principle.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that perspective. I don't even get this many calls from dentists on fluoride, so it's interesting.
Thank you.
It probably goes to illustrate the situation that the little things get to you more than the big things. Barney, I couldn't help but the way you dodged the Amendment 1 reminded me of an old professor we had when I was in university. He was this way on almost every issue. He couldn't quite, it really didn't affect him, and he wound up with the name No Burden Hilgert. And, we will reference you as No Burden State from now on. We have some other folks that signed up, and I owe Tad Brzezinski a problem. I know Tad at least partially, and I knew he was from Bend and had formerly been in Roseburg, and he didn't ride down 100 miles, and I looked at him and I thought he'd made another move since then, and he came up and said he'd come from over 100 miles, and so I apologized to him off the record last time for not having gotten them in on the earlier testimony, but it was a group, Joe Koss, Sean Murray, Tad Brzezinski, and Ken Holden, and if any one of them is there or anyone is carrying their testimony today, they're welcome to come and speak. Not seeing them in the crowd here, we'll go ahead and is there anyone else that wish to give? I'm sorry, Mary Botkin, excuse me. I don't recognize yellow stickies.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin with AFSCME Council 75. We actually want to give the committee a heads up. We have an issue that we certainly don't want to slow this bill down, and we can tell there's a lot of people who did a lot of work, but this bill has a relating to clause that we are particularly interested in. And, you know, I don't like to go to another chamber and make a change to a bill when there's an opportunity to chat with the Committee of Origin prior to doing that and letting you know that I have a new dress for this bill to wear. It can wear this one too. But we have an issue in state service, specifically in the Department of Corrections, that has become increasingly troublesome to us. We represent the dentists who work for the state of Oregon, both at the Department of Corrections and at the Oregon State Hospital. The Department of Corrections has, as you know, suffered some fairly significant budget cuts. As a result of those budget cuts, inmates are no longer given a full and complete dental restoration program within the department while they're serving time. That probably is not particularly troublesome to anybody other than the inmates, who have figured out that they can go to the Board of Dentistry and file a formal complaint with the Board of Dentistry, and the Board of Dentistry, in their inimitable wisdom, then issued a letter to one of our dentists specifically indicating that his license was under review because he was not practicing dentistry up to the, quote, community standard. And because he was not following dentistry to the level of community standard, his license would be revoked. This was very problematic. Our union immediately filed all the necessary paperwork, went to the department. The department went to the board. The board was unilaterally unhelpful and, in fact, antagonistic and, you'll excuse me, but slightly arrogant in their authority. And the only thing we know how to do is to take their authority away from them when it comes to supervising the licensing of state dentists who really do answer to the head of the medical department at the Department of Corrections. And, you know, we have no interest in, you know, demeaning the importance of some kind of a community standard for dentists. You know, we just don't think that our dentists within the department should be subject to that standard and have their licenses in jeopardy because of cuts in the budget that have been implemented by certainly nobody's fault, but, you know, I mean, this is a very serious problem for us. It's a very serious problem for our dentists. And, you know, if you wanted to amend the bill here, that'd be great. I need you to know what the issue is, and I need you to know that we can't just kind of ignore the issue and move on.
Well, Mary, I think there's a very simple situation.
Okay.
Somebody working for the state on a state patient. The attorney general's coming from every angle. The attorney general's on the board. Now, they can get that settled pretty fast amongst themselves if Hardy's got any leadership. And I just don't see this as a problem. I would be much more concerned from the fact that we're denying proper payment to our professionals all over the state, and that they would be, all of them, subject to that and subject to having the attorney general come down on them out there, with them having to go to a private attorney and pay for it themselves to get protection on this. So I basically think that that's something that can be worked out quite quickly if...
It's been almost 2 years, sir. We've not been able to find a solution to this at this point. I mean, I don't mean to argue with you, and I know it sounds like I am, but Senator Fisher, we have not found a solution.
Well, this has never been brought to my attention. I would have called the Attorney General and myself and said, hey, what gives here? Situation, because I see a situation where they're supposedly having to back a person in a correction facility against a person hired by the state against a board that they advise and work for. Now somebody's got to have some leadership over there and say this doesn't cut it. Your problem is no different. I've got umpteen board problems that I'm dealing with right now and have been dealing with other boards that have gone on 2-3 years and still not settled. People having to spend huge amounts of money in it. To my way of thinking, all a dentist has got to do here is go screaming to the attorney general. The attorney general is going to have to defend them and let the attorney general work it out.
Mr. Chair, our members have to hire their own attorneys. The attorney general represents the state of Oregon, not the dentist. They would have to hire their own attorney to defend themselves against the inmate's complaint, which is what we're experiencing.
Where is the dentist's office?
The dentist actually works for the state of Oregon and is housed inside the institution.
Then why are they treated any differently than anyone else?
Well, that's the problem. We are asking that they be treated differently. We're asking that the Board of Dentistry not have authority over their licensing process when they cannot meet the standard that the board has established due to budget cuts or budget curtailments. And very specifically, we state that it's in state institutions. We tried to narrow that very carefully.
Your argument is the fact that this is due to budget shortfall. the complaint can't be looked at that necessarily. It has to be looked at whether it is a faulty practice. I don't see a person being absolved just because we got a money shortfall and they don't have to answer to the board. That doesn't make any sense, because they can malpractice just the same as anyone else and have a right for the board to set in judgment on them. But I can't believe what I'm hearing, that a person that works and is hired by the state, unless he's, you know, how does the governor get protected? For instance, he's wind up being in all kinds of lawsuits, and they jump to his aid like crazy. They jump to my aid if I have any problem here because of, they already have done that. We've received lawsuits blanketed on our legislators, and they go right to bat and take care of that. So how are they getting out from under the fact that they have an employee that has not necessarily been proven of any kind of malpractice or anything like that, and they're not supporting him and making him go out to a private attorney? That makes no sense to me.
Well, it's an administrative process at this point, and they just simply, as it turned out, the Department of Corrections defended our dentist to the point where the board finally backed off. But I have to tell you, Senator Fisher, I made phone calls to the chair of this board for over a year, and never had one phone call received or returned trying to resolve this issue. Our staff rep made phone calls. We have tried to resolve this in any way, every way we could find out. We've had the full support of our department.
I wish you'd have made one phone call to me.
Mr. Chair.
And I may not have been able to solve it, but at least I would have been aware of it and certainly would have been working on it. But I see this as a problem. If we're going to talk about people not being able to do things, any dentist out here that can no longer do something, that maybe has to put a more temporary type thing or a lesser type treatment because of the cost, is going to be subject to this very same thing. And I'm not willing to let one small facet of dentists off the hook on that issue if we're not going to make that a blanket.
I certainly understand that.
Well, two questions, I guess. One, who does the Attorney General represent when it comes to the Board of Dentistry and a person who works for the state? It seems to me that if they hire an attorney, they would be going against the Attorney General, who would represent the Board of Dentistry. So that's a possibility. Secondly, the standard of practice in an institution, what is the standard of practice in an institution?
Same. According to the Board of Dentistry, according to Joanne Bones, it is the same as it is in the community. Unfortunately, we have cut back on our supplies and services and supplies to the point that we only do emergency dentistry now, so that if an inmate comes in with a toothache, we fix the tooth. We do not fix the entire mouth. And, you know, it, quite frankly, it's appalling to me that an inmate can force a dentist to live for a year with a cloud over their head, not knowing whether they're going to have their license revoked because of some scurrilous, you know, complaint. But that's the reality, and we're just trying to, you know, with all due respect, Mr. Chair, we really did try to draw this line narrow enough that it did not affect community dentistry, that it only affected people who worked in state institutions for the state of Oregon. And that's a very narrow group. And if we missed that mark, I apologize for that, but that was what we tried to do, and that's what we asked legislative council to do.
Well, I respect that aspect of it, but by the same token, I'm sick and tired of doing things for government employees that we don't do for private and nonprofit people. It's not fair. If it's a fairness issue there, it's a fairness issue somewhere else. And if some dentist, out of the kindness of his heart, works on somebody and he can't afford to do the full blown, but he takes care of the emergency, I don't want him suffering any more than do. And we have various times when I have pretty good idea that we have false complaints against practicing professionals in the private and nonprofit sector. And they go through this 2-3 year process themselves, and it's life threatening to them profession threatening and the whole bit. And I just am not willing to take one small segment here, especially not when I haven't seen the cuts in government that I've seen in private operations and stuff and nonprofit operations around the state. So I cannot believe, and Senator Morissette, you were a mayor. Mm-hmm. And I don't see you, if somebody made a complaint about you, I don't see you having to go out and hire a private attorney. I don't see somebody in your staff, if they would have made a complaint and there would have been a situation from you, you would have been protected by people that your city would have hired. And it just makes absolutely no sense that a deal like this, where you're dealing with three different areas that should be handled by the AG, that they can't get together and figure out some reasonable answer to that. But there again, maybe I expect too much.
This was my reasonable answer.
Well, I appreciate your concern, and I have some concerns along those lines, too, but I don't wish to clutter up 390 here with too many other issues. I will consider the new amendment of 25%, but I don't think that I wish to consider any other amendment on here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions? Thank you, Mary. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 390, and we'll work to get the proper amendment made and bring it back.
Mr. Chair, may I clarify that that's the 25% ownership that you're talking about?
Yes, okay. That's correct. Now I'll close the public hearing.
Okay.
We have some public hearings here for the purpose of... I'm sorry. We're getting 461 here. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 461.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 461 limits the cost of group homes operated by the Department of Human Services to the costs paid to nonprofit community provider organizations who operate similar homes.
Mr. Vice Chair, would you run the gavel? I wish to go down and testify on this bill.
I'll be ready to hear it.
He's going to come down and test it.
Chair Morissette and committee members,
I'm sorry, would you identify yourself?
I will, sir. I'm Senator Bill Fisher, District 1. I had this bill drafted, and it's not drafted exactly the way I asked for it, but it got the job done with relating clauses. We've had a situation that's been under considerable scrutiny for some time in the payment of state-operated group homes and other homes in the private and nonprofit sector that are providing the same type of services, basically to many of the same type of and same category of skill of care. The price that's being paid to a state-run group home is over twice what is being paid to members of the private and nonprofit sector. Not only that, when the budget cuts and things happened, monies were cut and programs were cut remarkably to these private and nonprofit sector group homes. And to my knowledge, there were no cuts made whatsoever to the state operated homes providing the same type of care. This bill should have read that it would not allow the state to pay itself for any patient any more than what it paid the private and nonprofit sector for a person of that same level of skilled care. And they got it a little bit backwards there, and I'm going to work to do it, but I intend to have a hearing on this and see what we want to do to proceed to straighten this out. It's absolutely unforgivable for the state to make arguments to pay itself over twice what they're willing to pay in the private and nonprofit sector for the same thing. It smacks of absolute poor administration and poor policy. And I don't think they have any right to continue that practice. So that's the reason that Senate Bill 461 was drawn up. And I'll go ahead now and we have others that wish to testify on it, we'll get to that.
So your intent is to have the amendment here before we...
Well, I want to hear the testimony.
I want to hear the testimony.
And, work toward drawing up an amendment if we feel that there's a reason to proceed. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Okay, John Cooper, would you please come up, please? John? Okay.
Senator Fisher, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Cooper. I manage state-operated community programs. Previous to managing state-operated community programs, I was superintendent of Fairview Training Center during the time of its closure. The information that I'm providing you is information that was provided to the emergency board this last spring as a result of a budget note requesting that we take a look at state-operated group homes and private homes, and that we pull a committee together to be able to address a number of issues, to look at alternatives, to review the staffing and other operating costs of state-operated homes, and to make some comparison between private homes and the state homes. Information, originally at Fairview Training Center, there was a process that reviewed every client that lived there and tried to make the most appropriate placement possible for that person considering their disability. If people in that review process got to a certain level of risk, they were put in a state-operated group home rather than a private home. The people who were doing the reviews were at Fairview were the physician, physical therapist, occupational therapist, social worker. There was speech pathologist, psychiatrist, and psychologist that were all involved, along with families and a United States Department of Justice attorney that was representing the United States Department of Justice as part of a consent decree.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Brown.
I just would like to ask a question for clarification. So what I hear you saying is that the folks needing a higher level of care, more intensive services, and that was determined by this panel, went into state-operated group homes. Folks needing a lower level of services, less intensive care, went into private, nonprofit-type homes. Is that?
That's correct.
Okay.
People that I know that Senator Fisher was doing a lot of the review at the time, that a lot of the controversy occurred around some of the placements during that time. And people who there was paraded across a number of newspapers throughout the Willamette Valley, sort of the sexual histories of a number of clients who lived at Fairview. People who were in that category became part of state-operated community programs. There were a number of people with very intense medical needs that became part of community programs. And since the Fairview closure has occurred, there have been some people who have moved out of state-operated programs into private homes because their acuity level has gotten below the level of the kind of services that were provided. The need for having as expensive and as staff-intensive services as are provided in state-operated homes. Almost everyone who's come into state-operated community programs since that time have come from the state hospital, Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center. They've been institutional placements from other institutions other than Fairview. So I think it's important to know that although there are isolated examples, I'm sure, where someone with very similar issues are served out in the community, where we have looked at homes that were as close as we could find, the acuity level of people being served in those homes was very different than the acuity level of people that were in state-operated programs. We looked at a home that was in Roseburg in Senator Fisher's area and did a comparison using a nationally recognized acuity scale for people who have medical issues. and found a pretty substantial difference between the services that were provided there and the services that we provide in our medical homes. And that's pretty consistently true as well with the behavioral homes. This report has more detail on that. And if the report itself lists a number of attachments, and if people would like to have copies of those attachments, I'll be glad to provide them. I didn't hear, just because of the amount of paper that would require.
The thing that that I observed, and I toured Fairview, I believe I was there your last day.
Yes.
If I remember right. And it was rather interesting because in the one particular facility there that we toured, how much difficult can total care be than total care? And you were taking care of people there in a manner in which I would have been literally thrown out of business immediately at what time I was there. The type of facility that you had, the lack of privacy, all kinds of issues that we would not have been allowed to do. We take care of people in private and nonprofit care all the time and need total care. And I maintain that just because somebody has a mental condition and doesn't know what's going on, or because they've had a stroke and don't know what's going on, they're no different than taken care of. Their skin is no more tender. There's nothing about the care that they need that isn't provided in a private setting. To my knowledge, and correct me if I'm wrong, you have not been increasing beds in this type of care as the needs of the population grows. And all the testimony that we've had in times past has been that this population grows just about on an even ratio as our total overall state population grows. So where you're not adding consistently beds, there can only be one conclusion, that those people that continue to grow are being taken care of in the private sector just the same as they're being taken care of in the state. Now, I laud the fact that you try to keep the most, the most difficult patients. However, a lot of times in the situation that you have, where you have some type of sexual problems or sexual predators, which primarily were some of the forensic type needs that you take care of, you don't have a patient that actually is as hard and time-consuming to take care of. Oftentimes, they can do a little more for themselves than some of the ones that take total bed care. And it's a matter more of making sure they don't get out and go somewhere and do something they're not supposed to do. And from that standpoint, for instance, a nursing home owner-operator, I would much sooner take care of somebody that wandered, but that could take himself to the restroom and go to the restroom by himself, that could eat, feed himself and all that kind of stuff. He's not half the problem for me to take care of just because he wanders. And so from that standpoint, I don't buy your categorization of residents and patients from my own observation. And the amount of money that was being spent at Fairview was absolutely atrocious. In the first place, you got yourself into the Department of Justice problems by the way that Fairview had been operated in the past. Do you think that the Department of Justice, if they had got after some private or nonprofit citizen, would have been as lenient in what they did and allowing things to go on like they would? No, they wouldn't. So that was a situation that basically the state has only itself to blame for. And it wasn't from the fact that they weren't pumping money into that thing hand over fist. It was poor, poor management. And that's the thing that is bothering me about this whole thing, is the fact that you will take poor management and pay for it rather than get out and treat people reasonably, that you will perhaps use a different standard in making judgments as to who's hard to take care of and who isn't. And we are asked to use in the private and nonprofit sector. And that's where my objections come. And We've got several other people that want to testify here, and I'm not trying to be hard-nosed about it. I just want to see people treated equally. And that's why I didn't like what it said here, because it said about paying the home more. I'm not interested in how much the home is paid. I'm interested in how much is paid per day for the type of patient that you have to take care of. If you're going to average their resident, give an average payment, then you ought to have to average yours and give them be paid under the same basis. And that's what I'm trying to seek here, as a matter of fairness, and get to the bottom of the situation as to why we seem to think it's necessary to pay over twice for the patients that are being taken care of by the and in government-owned operations than we are in private and nonprofit sectors. Because under my observation, you're not even licensed and inspected to the same standards that we are in the private sector or nonprofit sector.
Senator Fisher, currently the state-operated community programs are licensed under the exact same standard that any private group home is licensed under. We have the same survey visits and the same surveyors and the same requirements that they have for operating in exactly the same way. We have two reasons that our costs are somewhat higher. One of the reasons is that, of course, our staffing is higher to deal with as we see it issues that are significantly different. The other is that a lot of our employees are long-term employees that were employed at Fairview Training Center. And if we had the turnover that exists in private providers, at I think 75% or so with the last figures that I heard, our costs would be about $4,000 less per person per month. But because we were able to pick from all of the direct care and other staff at Fairview when state-operated community programs established homes, we have people that have worked doing that kind of work for 8, 10, and a lot longer years.
So do we in the private sector, and it makes absolutely no difference the amount we're paid. That's no excuse when it comes out to where our budgets are figured or anything else. And so I would offer the same thing to you. I have employees that have worked for me for 25 years or more, and we have lots of 10-year employees. We have good people, and so, you know, I'm not interested in playing that kind of a game. It's not even germane to it. Nobody ever figures or comes down and said, oh, you've kept your employees for a long period of time, so we're going to give you more. I wish it were that easy.
Well, I just know in the home that I looked at in Roseburg, that was a comparison home with the medical homes. One of the significant differences there, they had salary scales that were stepped off like the state scales were, and almost everyone was between first and second step of their salary scale, where in our home, almost everyone is at the top of their step, and it made a significant difference there.
Well, we'd like to be able to pay the same thing, and I think we could have a significant difference then, too, if we got that same amount. And that's where my point is. Sid Stoller? James Good? Ed Lindquist? We got three chairs.
I'm going to stay with my script, ladies and gentlemen. I regret very much that full legislative staff isn't here to hear it. I've been very upset in the past to come down and find committees that are supposed to be operating with staff said or they're not. Only one or two people are here to hear the testimony. When we have taken the time and energy not only to travel here but to carefully prepare our testimony, I think it's grossly unfair, I might say. My name is Sid Stiller.
You have a right to your opinion, but I'm also going to say that we have other duties and things that require us to be out of here in certain times. We all have access to the testimony that's given. It's on record. in. We do the best we can, but you're not the only constituents that we have, and there's people coming up all the time that need everything from housing to drugs to everything else that come in and we have to get to work on. So most of us try to do the very best we can, and we're willing to work and listen, and that's my answer to your problem. We're not being derogatory to you in any way, shape, or form. It's just a matter of getting the work done that we have to do here. Go ahead, sir.
My wife, Ann, and I are parents and guardians of a 41-year-old severely retarded and dually diagnosed daughter residing in a state-operated community program. Dually diagnosed means that she has a psychiatric condition on top of mental retardation. We're intensely involved in her life. I'm a board member of the VOR, which is a national advocacy organization for mentally retarded, developmentally disabled people. I've had the opportunity to visit group homes and institutions, both public and private, in several states as well as in Scandinavia. My wife and I have both served on different boards of MRDD caregiving agencies in Oregon. I was privileged to serve on the interim study group authorized by a budget note in the last session of the legislature concerning privatizations of state-operated community programs. Our experiences in these various roles and our daughter's history cause us to oppose this measure. The question of whether state-operated group homes should be compelled to operate at the same cost as private non-profit agencies do with similar clientele is the question, and we are speaking here of less than 6% of all of the facilities for MRDD in Oregon. That is, out of 572 such facilities, we're talking about 33. We're also talking about 147 individual people who are constitute 2.9% of all of those who are getting 24-hour care. That's not a very high statistic. This bill undermines the intent and purpose of the long-range plan to close Fairview by the legislature. That plan helped establish the SOCPs as the safety net for Oregon's most difficult and vulnerable population. There is no definition in this bill of what similar means, and similar is not identical. Every person is an individual and deserves individual attention. Besides lacking criteria for this judgment, there is no mention who would decide, even if similarly were more closely defined. When Fairview Training Center closed, residents were assigned to SOCP homes on a set of specific criteria, which included the need for intensive care of extremely medically fragile and dually diagnosed persons, persons with challenging behaviors and dangerous to themselves or others, or persons who had been in and out of the institution multiple times in private community placements and who were too great a liability for private agencies to absorb. Our daughter was among that group. She was among the last to leave Fairview. In previous private care, she'd been sexually abused, acted out her anger, was forcibly removed from the agency. We had to hospitalize her in a private psychiatric hospital and then keep her at home. We were denied care by private agencies in our county. Finally, she entered Fairview, where she received the care necessary to aid in her recovery. During her stay at Fairview, she was again denied placement by private community provider organizations. Each individual among the last group of Fairview residents to leave was given a thorough assessment of his or her medical, dental, psychiatric, social, and other needs. Professional staff, group home representatives, families, guardians were all involved in these assessments. Private agencies got the pick of those who they thought they could serve, and our daughter and others like her were not among them. Our daughter now has a life. She has part-time employment, which allows her to make a modest contribution to her care, and she has shown some recovery from the abuse that she suffered in private care at an earlier time. At the behest of her psychiatrist and at our behest, she receives care from female-only personnel. The interim study group, of which I was a member, examined a number of documents which Mr. Cooper has in his possession, And we noted that among those, that private nonprofits may exclude persons whom they feel they cannot serve. And they have stated during the study that they wanted to retain this right. SOCPs, then, are akin to intensive care units of hospitals. Patients in such units receive the care they need, but it's more expensive care. Likewise, people in SOCPs receive costlier care and supervision, which they require. These SOCPs were created as the safety net to replace Fairview Training Center. They're the only backup system Oregon now has. Discrepancies in cost of care exist because SOCPs utilize former Fairview Direct Care staff with the knowledge and experience to deal with the clientele they have. Much is expected of them. Many of them commute from Salem to outlying areas of Willamina and Portland area. They must double shift when required, and in addition to their supervisory duties, they perform household and maintenance tasks which, at Fairview, were performed by other employees. As state employees, they're entitled to fair compensation according to labor management agreements. This accounts for much of the difference between the SOCPs and the nonprofits. But in reference to that experience, with attrition over time, these discrepancies should diminish. Because of the wage and benefit differences, if this bill were to pass, SOPs could be forced to reduce staff beyond what is required for the health and safety of residents. The interim study group learned that state employees would not automatically give up their benefits to work for private entities. When our daughter, among others, were relocated to an SOPC home from Fairview, it was explained to her and to us that this would be her home. As we have personally experienced it, private agencies want to retain the right to exclude residents. The idea of moving clients from one residence to another to accommodate the needs of a system would create further instability, which is not needed by people who are medically fragile or have psychiatric problems. Our daughter wouldn't understand it. It would only serve to aggravate her tenuous condition. If private agencies can remove MRDD residents, it doesn't sound much like home to us. I'm informed by Department of Human Services personnel that a few private agencies which deal with medically challenged clients are provided with increased compensation to help cover their costs. The private nonprofit agencies have access to a source of funds which are denied to SOCPs. Some agencies engage in fundraising or utilize shadow corporations to do the fundraising for them, and that was the case when I served on a board of a private agency. There simply has to be a safety net program for persons like our daughter. The state cannot abandon its responsibilities to those citizens in the manner the private agencies may if they feel they can't cope. According to federal law, parents and guardians play primary decision-making roles in the programs and supports their disabled family members receive. To deny this small percentage of MRDD residents the care they need would become a health and safety issue and could well drive us into the federal courts for relief. I most strongly urge you to abandon support for this kind of a bill that attacks the most vulnerable citizens. Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Speller, I am not trying to make light in any way, shape, or form of the needs of you and your family, and you certainly have my sympathies in that. But I would, by the same token, say that you're not the only one that faces those type of things. And there's many, many, many that have not been maybe as fortunate as you haven't had in that. As far as the sexual charges and stuff like that, there's no excuse for that. That certainly has happened several times in the Fairview history. It's happened over in the state hospital history. People are people wherever they're at, and we're going to have rogues any way you look at it. And I would guess, without saying, that there was never any offer by the state when you had your daughter in a private setting to increase the rate similar to what they would get at the state hospital, which might allow them to provide some of the things that you indicate you missed when she was in a private or nonprofit setting. It certainly is a situation that I don't envy you. I sympathize with you. I sympathize with the others. And I'm not saying that the money can't increase to somebody else. I'm only saying if they're going to pay that at the state level, then do the same thing for the other people out there that aren't getting it. And that's where I have had a problem with what goes on, because I do indeed sympathize with you. I know how hard it is to provide that type of care. I know how hard it is to get good employees. But it doesn't excuse the state for making a big discrepancy. And as I stated in my testimony, the bill was not drawn to my specifications. I'm not blaming you for speaking to what the bill says, because you've got to do that, because that's what the bill says. That isn't what the bill was designed to do. The bill was designed to take better care of everybody in the system and to make it on an even basis rather than impinge upon any particular person in the system. Go ahead, sir.
Honorable Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jim Good, James C. Good, Sr. I'm here to express my strong opposition to Senate Bill 461. I've enclosed in my packet some written material that I want to go through that, if you get the chance, I hope you'll be able to read it. Personally, my wife and I have been involved in issues of care and support for mentally retarded persons for many years. We both, my wife has been vice president of the Oregon Association of Retarded Citizens. I was the pro bono attorney for that association for many years. We have been active locally, historically, in establishing schools in our local community. And as I'll say later, we were the founders of the first group home, private group home, a nonprofit in the city of Albany, which was followed up by four or five others under that umbrella. We also, my wife served as chairman of that board for many, many years, and I chaired the board for schooling for handicapped or retarded people. Over 20 years ago, my wife and I had to place our son, Jim Jr., in a nonprofit private home. We were unable to care for him ourselves. The medical event that caused this, in addition to retardation, was he's becoming a very brittle, insulin-dependent diabetic. In addition to all of his other problems of diabetes, he developed periods of rage where he was out of control and dangerous to himself and others. He entered and was put out of six group homes, private group homes, as a result of his medical problems and his behavior. This included a time at a group home in Albany that my wife and I founded, the Chamberlain House. We named that after her parents, Russ and Lila Chamberlain. As you can imagine, the last thing in the world the staff at Chamberlain House wanted to do was to dismiss the son of the founders of that group home, but they felt they had no choice. This was his fourth or fifth placement. Another was a group home in Springfield that was specially built with his needs in mind. He was discharged from there in less than a month and sent to Fairview. Later, the group home staff asked to have him come back to have another try, and at that he lasted for about 2 weeks. He was at Fairview for many years, doing well under the circumstances, and we vigorously opposed the closure of Fairview and testified a number of times. Senator Fisher,
that's correct,
was the chair of that, and also at those meetings exhibited his personal bias or position, even though he's a member of the committee. And we're seeing that again today, as Senator Fisher obviously is the sponsor of Senate Bill 461. I have a little difficulty in understanding roles here in the legislative process. Being a retired judge myself, this kind of falls in the face of everything that I've been taught and been up with, been experienced with. One of the strongest reasons for opposition to Fairview closure was it left no fallback or other facility in case the private homes could not handle the resident and would discharge him or her without any other home being available. The state responded to this concern by promising there would be a state of Oregon operated homes to handle the most complex and difficult residents by reason of retardation, overall medical condition, and behavior. We were told and promised on a number of occasions that our son would never be discharged for any reason from the state op home. Other parents and guardians were told the same. We were promised that the state-operated homes would be staffed by dedicated and experienced individuals, most of whom had been staffed at Fairview for many years. Because of their experience of the complexity of the retardation and other medical conditions and behavioral problems of the expected state group home residents, the staff would receive a higher rate of pay, and medical and related expenses would likewise be higher than those in the private sector. The need for highly qualified and experienced persons who manage and staff the state-operated homes is a critical cornerstone of the post-Fairview program, which also provides a measure of fallback facility that was and is so critical to meeting the needs of the MRDD citizen. Our son presents complex disabilities, including retardation, diabetes attendant with those problems, a kidney failure requiring two major surgeries, seizures, osteoporosis, multiple fractures of both femurs and shoulders, also requiring surgery. His medications are numerous. His blood sugar level goes up and down in dangerous numbers. It's necessary for him to be awakened during the night for blood sugar testing, as low levels at night have resulted in major seizure violent enough to cause fracture. All there may be exceptions, the lower paid and overall less experienced staffs in the private homes in reality cannot adequately address the many complex issues. This poses a significant danger element to the clients and the public. Obviously, our son is not alone in requiring skilled and experienced attending staff. All of the staff in the state-operated homes must meet the same kinds of and even greater challenges than our son poses. You cannot separate pay and quality of care issues. They earn their pay, and it's of necessity higher than staffs in the non-private sector. Putting these residents in a setting where there are lesser staff skills is nothing short of dangerous. In addition, as I mentioned earlier, the private homes are under no requirement that they keep residents they cannot handle or adequately care for. I remember one group home director telling me that, quote, we have five residents in this home, and your son takes more than 50% of staff time. And that was before he suffered any seizures and multiple fractures. The enclosed data you may have seen from other sources, the state-operated system has been examined and investigated by outside experts and received accolades for the program as being the best. The existence of a professionally more experienced staff in state-operated homes played a major part in that assessment. The proposed bill, even as amendment, leaves major definition issues. What are similar health and safety needs? How is provide services defined? How is the quality of services measured? With the pay and overall education and staff experience differentials, how can it possibly meet the needs of the state-operated home? These are life and death issues. At this point, SB 461 is nothing short of frightening to my wife and I and all other families and guardians who have loved ones in the state of Oregon operated group homes. And I have individually, and my wife has toured so many nonprofit homes, and we're still active in that, so we know what goes on in those homes, I suspect, more than anybody in the room. Thank you.
I might say that the judicial branch seems just as mysterious to us as you might think the legislative branch is mysterious to you.
Mr. Chairman, Ed Lindquist, a former legislator, so maybe I can speak a little more about the legislature in this process. My son Eric is in a facility here in Salem, and Eric is now 40 years old. My wife was first pregnant with Eric, she got the measles and ran a temperature, a very high temperature for about 3 days, and so it became a microcephalic is the term that they use, but it just stopped his brain from growing at the regular rate. When Eric was born, we discovered the problem, and he went to Fairview at a very early age, and when we started the process of downsizing Fairview, we took him out and put him in a private facility in Clackamas County. And I then, as a county commissioner, helped build the facilities and lease them to the agencies to try to make this whole process work with the private facilities. I have to tell you, the care that he received in the private facility was very stressful for me because I saw turnovers where people very, very seldom lasted for over 6 months. Now, maybe the facility you run is different than the ones that I've seen. Some of the lead people stay, but the people that do the day-to-day work in the facilities, the turnover is drastic. And these people meant well. I have nothing to say bad against them. It's just that they would burn out. In about 6 months, they were gone and would get a job someplace else. That is the problem that I have with the private facilities. Now, if they were paid more, and maybe that's the intent of this, is to pay them more toward what the state facilities get.
I was going to ask you, what would double the rate mean?
Yeah.
It certainly would
I would think, provide for a little more stability. And
that may be the answer, but I can tell you that the care that they get in the state facility, and that's where Eric is now, because he is medically fragile now. He has a tube in his tummy that must be fed through. He has scoliosis very seriously, and so he has to be treated with that bone disease. He must be taken care of every so many hours, must be moved and massaged, and I'm sure you know about that. The care that he got in the private facility, I felt, and I may be wrong, I'm not a doctor, I have two brother-in-laws that are surgeons, but I felt that the care that he got in the private facility was the reason we ended up back in the state-run facility, because he didn't get the care that he should have had there. Nevertheless, he is in the facility here in Salem. He's very happy there. We like the facility. We like the people that work there. They know Eric. They understand his needs. I can understand a few things that he needs occasionally, but I don't understand about 75% of what he says and what he needs. The people that work with him do, because they're with him all the time. Several of them came from Fairview, and so they even knew him at Fairview. So I would question the way the bill is drafted, and I understand you have amendments coming up, but the way it's drafted, that it doesn't really get at what we need, and that's to make sure that those people, those medically fragile and those behavioral folks, get the level of care that we think that they've got, that's a bare minimum that they're getting now in the state facility, that we don't want to see that done away with. Now, let me say one other thing. In my 10 years in the legislature, I chaired a subcommittee of Ways and Means for two of the sessions. And I would view this bill as actually taking away my authority as a Ways and Means member to set the budget, depending on the need on a particular year or particular biennium, for what's needed for those people. I would hesitate to vote for this as a Ways and Means member, saying, why would I want to limit my own ability as a budget writer to change that year to year, depending upon the need of those people and what's going on in the state facility? But that's so I know you have.
How does the bill do that?
Well, if it's meant to limit the money that goes to the state facilities, and I'm not quite sure if it's meant to do that, and that's why I suggested earlier, maybe you're trying to raise the amount that goes to the privates. I'm not sure. But if it limits the amount of money or says we can't pay the state costs as they are, then that would limit how many people can be in that facility and how the Ways and Means Committee can do that. So I would view that as it's currently written to be very questionable.
Well, and that's, again, I'm not questioning you speaking to the bill, because that's what you have.
Yes.
And my intent was not necessarily that at all, but it was the intent to establish a fair evaluation that was utilized on residents in the state homes and residents in private nonprofit facilities, and if indeed under the same evaluation process they are taking care of heavier class patients, I have no objection to that. We have very minor ability to change that once in a while in the private and nonprofit sector, because it is recognized that some people are a little more difficult to take care of than others. But by the same token, we're also limited, which I don't believe the state is. They set us up in our, and it was testimony that we're licensed under the same. We're not, because we're limited in who we can take care of in a very definite manner, and if we overstep that, then we're in trouble. So we can't guarantee that we're going to take care of somebody forever, because we can't do it. For instance, in a nursing home, you can't take care of an Alzheimer's patient when they get in a certain stage. Now, it's not that we can't. We can do it just as efficiently as the state, but government, for some reason, has said, no, you can't do that. So they have to be transferred out and transferred back. Well, I can't guarantee to take care of that person for the rest of their life like the state can, because they're automatically assumed, for some reason or another, to be way more caring and more have ability to give caregiving. And the only thing that I can say is that when they leave my facility at $100 a day and go somewhere else for $7,000 a month, I would think that I could probably do just a little bit better, if I could have access to that same kind of a change. So that's the thing that I'm really objecting to, is the fact that we will basically be saddled with persons of a particular need and a particular medical level, and demand that we take care of them at basically a much less amount than that same person would get if we just transferred them straight across to the state-run homes.
It would seem to you, Mr. Chair, and I understand where you're coming from, but it would seem to me that the very thing you're trying to do would be the state would view that as to find out a way to do this as it's currently written. We would have to set up some kind of a review board to look at the levels of service in those different facilities and the costs of those, and I could see a bureaucracy that I'm sure that you would not be in favor of. But how do we do that? And this doesn't address that, of course.
Well,
how do we...
there are caseworkers out there that make those kind of decisions all the time as to whether it's skilled or intermediate or assisted living. There's no reason that those things, it doesn't take another bureaucracy. Those things can be applied straight across the board. That shouldn't be a great problem. This basically, as far as I'm concerned, is a matter of fairness.
And I'm not debating you, of course, and I don't have a problem with the fairness, but I do believe that the level of service that's required in the state-run facilities for the behavioral and medically fragile may be a different level of service than you normally provide in the private side, and so therefore you have people that are more experienced and are paid more. I would question if it's double the cost, too. And in fact, I've talked to both of the co-chairmen of Ways and Means, the current co-chairman, and asked them, you know, when you look at the budget, look at it with a fine-tooth comb and see what's going on here. It shouldn't be double the rate that's in the private if it's the same level of care. And so I have some of the same questions you do, except that as a parent, I don't want to see the service cut to the people that are in these facilities either. Of all the people who were in Fairview when you folks took it apart and sent the people out to private, and I actually tried that and supported it, as I think you've heard both of these people have tried that too, we ended up back in the state-run facility because we needed a greater level of care, and we just couldn't get it in the private facilities. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be looking forward to the amendments, but in its current form, I certainly have to oppose the measure.
Well, I would say and assure you that I would not be willing to vote for it in this form either. And that's a frustration that we have because several bills have been in the paper recently and they were not in any way, shape, drawn up like they had anticipated. So, and I would say that, yes, I know you understand some of the problems that we go through here sometimes developing a bill. And I'm not going to, as I said, support a bill like this written myself, and as I wanted to testify first, assure people that this was not the bill that I wanted to support. And I have no objection whatsoever to increasing the pay to care situations outside of the government arena. That doesn't bother me a bit. But what I really object to is using that as a budget balancer.
Mm-hmm.
In only one arena, rather than going through the whole situation. If it's all right to just cut things to the private and the nonprofit sector, and government go right on whizzing along the way it is, to me, that's no ways near a fair operation, because I look upon it as you as a parent have tried, and obviously, and I commend you on that for your work with the nonprofit. I would guess the home that you found was nonprofit. And what you've tried to do, and recognizing that, but I think that given the difference in the state rate, if you had that same rate, I think that you could build a facility or operate a facility where you could probably duplicate the same thing, because, again, I see human beings taking care of human beings, and I don't see that it makes a difference whether it's in government arena or whether it's in a private or nonprofit arena. That can be done if it's in a fair manner, and it could be required. And it could be required under proper vision that if somebody came in, that would be their home.
Aside from the, Chair, the issues of pay, we think that the issue of permanency is as important, and the private sector, and I'd say we're heavily involved in that, can say we can't handle you. Goodbye. And
well, under the rules,
can't say that.
Under the rules and regulations we have, in some cases, we're not allowed to take care of people that we can't
right.
take care of.
So we don't have any fallback. We don't have any, that's a major issue. We've seen these loved ones of ours pushed out the door. And the pay, obviously, and the other expenses are major issues, but so is the permanency or long-term commitment an important issue, as important.
Thank you for taking your time to come and give us obviously what brings back painful memories and makes them just much more poignant, I think, in the situation. I've dealt with many, many, many families in the last 35 years that had some pretty tough things to surmount. Incidentally, we do have one resident that has been in the nursing home that I've been involved with for 37 years. Wow. 37 years.
Thank you, sir.
Colleen Savage, Ralph Groner, and Ralph Rizzuto.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and distinguished members of the panel. For the record, my name is Ralph Groner, representing AFSCME.
From another former legislator that understands.
Well, you didn't have to say that. Yes. Well, many years ago.
Now, when you said distinguished, you didn't look up and down the line.
No, I did. At each and every one of you.
Oh, you did.
Especially Senator Starr.
Oh, especially Senator.
Yes, I went right by you. I'm kidding. Okay.
No. By the way, we have four of the 11 most grizzled members of the legislature in this committee right now.
Four of the 11 most
grizzled. I've been called a lot of things, but never grizzled.
You think about that one for a while.
You really weren't including Senator Clarno, were you? Well, I was going to testify on something different than I am now, so please bear with me because I can see the sincerity and the interest you have, Mr. Chair. So I was going to talk about some of the things like, and I'm just going to forget all that, because really what we, the union, are after is really becoming clearer that even though said differently, the question of parity is a question that's important to our union, and I want that very clear with both political parties. So let me explain why. Our union represents the state-op employees. However, we also represent private nonprofit MRDD group homes. And maybe we didn't work as hard as some in the audience might think we should have for increased salary for the private, but if you were to go to the co-chairs of last session and say, who came to you the first day of the session, went to lunch, and talked about our top priority, which was salary increases and benefit increases and money for the private nonprofit, you will find that Representative Westland will tell you it was me and Mary Botkin. And so we may not have been publicly like some come in and testify, but we know, and since I grew up here, know that it really often occurs with a Ways and Means chair privately. We still care about that 100%, but I think sometimes we're getting off into kind of analogous to Measure 5 to me. We rob Peter to pay Paul. We rob the state to pay local. In this case, I don't want to take a quality program like the state op group home, and because you can get into all the data you want, and I had all that, and I'm going to bypass that. But rather, if in fact what we're after is parity, then what we really need, I was going to mention, you know, our average salary in the state ops is $13 an hour, and the average salary in the private, by the way, we've all worked for that, and you have too, is $9.50. If you got a little compliment, we've moved that up, and we've reduced our turnover in the private sector now from 100%, my understanding is, down to something like 3 out of 4 or 75%, because you have increased the salary and the benefits at the private sector. However, our $13 rate includes our benefits and includes the most of ours. Our members had 7 years on the average training, several hundred hours when they came out of the Fairview Center. So our most highly trained people went right into the state op. And I want people to remember the one fact, and that is that of the 5,000 folks who clients who came out. We're only talking 144 remaining, 95 behavioral and 44. I better check that, 95 and 49. 95 behavioral clients, 49 medically fragile. And so you know those definitions. I know you all do already. So we're really talking a small group that has been decided should belong or have tried these other sectors for almost all of them. Some of them, I was reading, my goodness, I have 95 people have had 273 institutional and 187 private placements. So here's what we do. We satisfy the chair, and we satisfy all of us, and most importantly, we satisfy those who are the MRDD and their families. And what we really do is we say, we have a wonderful program at the state op level. We need to keep that. I don't happen to think $13 an hour is overly expensive myself, but some might, but we have 11% turnover. That ought to be a goal of the private sector. The only thing Ralph Kroner would want to, well, we're going to try to unionize you know that. We're already the union in the private sector, but I don't want to knock the unions. We work very hard to make sure we get benefits for these people and that they have health coverage and dental coverage and the kinds of things they need as a family. That's what we're really about today in this era. And so we want to make sure there's parity also, but we want to make sure that when that money does go to that private sector, and we could do that with standards established by the legislature, that doggone it, if we're getting 13 over here, then let's work to make sure we're getting those kinds of salaries over there. If we're getting these benefits over here, don't get me wrong, my God, health benefit alone. I'll sidetrack just a sec. My staff asked me to go over to Astoria to do what's called internal organizing. We were having some problems. I door-to-doored to talk to our current members. Some of them fair share. I was sent out to like 15 mobile homes, all of whom I had not been through anything like this. So this was quite an experience. They worked for our private. It was our private contract, and I talked to them, and they'd have three or four little children, the mother usually, no spouse, who worked at the facility, but the medical coverage had a high deductible, and I'm not knocking the private here, high deductible, but there was no coverage for the children. And I say, how do you get medical coverage? That was door-to-door for these children. And they say, well, they're on the Oregon Health Plan. So I want to make a point you don't hear very often. This is for both sides. If we don't get these salaries and benefits up at the private level, they're costing you on taxpayer dollars somewhere else. And where they're costing you is in getting their children and their family on the Oregon Health Plan or through other services that are provided by the public. So it makes sense economically, be you conservative, and I don't think there are liberals left, although you might probably think there are, but I don't. If they are, they don't say it. I don't think that it's good policy not to work towards parity so that we have a quality private sector that is paying decent salaries, providing decent benefits, and reducing that turnover, which we're all after. We can't reduce the turnover from the current 75, which came down from 100, according to the data, statewide, if we don't do what I'm talking about. But we haven't had the money recently. That's an understatement. And we had a quarter in there for salary on the private, or if I may be wrong on that number, this last, special session, and it finally went for the private. It was gone. It was removed. We tried. Everybody wanted to keep it. So I would hope what we do, rather than feelings of a bill that comes out that appeared to be, it appeared this way, an attack on the state ops, but rather to say, you've got a system where we only have 5 emergency beds at Eastern Oregon, plus our state op. One of the cuts we had was our new group home. Was that last special? Colleen can answer that. Last special session. One of the special sessions. The state has a problem in that when people do have it, the private sector, a crisis, we're running into a crisis similar to the mental health system at the state hospital where we don't have enough beds. I just want to say that. So one way or another, we have to deal with that either at the private or the public sector. So rather than us appearing at a bill that says, let's take from Peter to pay Paul, what we really ought to be doing, in my opinion, is say, let's have a wonderful state op system that, by the way, the cost, if you really want to get into that, I'd like to one day, because when you look at those budgets, one of the things that's left out is that our state ops are all inclusive. So in their budget, in their cost, they include vocational. Now, don't get me wrong, some of the private do, but not all. Not all. Some of the wonderful, bigger ones do. Transportation, et cetera, are inclusive in our budget, but not necessarily in all the private. So I want you to be aware on that analysis twice as much. If we were to get in a debate, which we aren't going to, hopefully, please, no, is that it isn't apple to apple. So my ending thought as a junior, a labor lobbyist, is let's not fight each other, but rather work together to do what we need. If you could see the private sector members I have and the lifestyle they're living, within 5 minutes, you would change what's happening. I'll be honest. I have had terrible nightmares, as I told my staff, about what I saw. And that is that this state and this government is sponsoring a program for the mentally retarded and developmentally disabled, and in fact have salaries out there and benefits so low that people cannot succeed, nor can they survive. And that is not, in my opinion only, the ethical thing to do. Not the political thing, the ethical thing. So we have a system that's broken. We need to work toward parity in behalf of the client and the parents and so forth. So I appreciate this discussion. And I'd like to introduce, if you don't mind.
Ralph, I've got to do four hearings here. Just take a moment. But I want to do it while I've got a committee. And we'll go ahead. And do we have a 3 o'clock meeting in here?
Yes. We do have a 3 o'clock.
Okay, so we'll have to
do those with any number of members, but you just have to get them done.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go ahead and do them right now. So I'm going to recess the public hearing on Senate Bill 461 and hold a public hearing on Senate Bill 144. Staff?
Oh, okay. Sorry about that. Senate Bill 144 requires hospitals to record external cause of injury, poisoning, or adverse effect on hospital uniform billing forms and ambulatory surgery and inpatient discharge records.
Okay. We'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 144 and open a hearing on Senate Bill 288.
Senate Bill 288 modifies the disciplinary authority of the Oregon State Board of Nursing.
I close a public hearing on Senate Bill 288 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 865.
Senate Bill 865 directs DHS to seek a waiver to deny eligibility for medical assistance to otherwise eligible applicants receiving or eligible for health care benefits from the Veterans Health Administration or from another employer-sponsored plan.
Okay, close a public hearing on Senate Bill 865 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 885.
Senate Bill 885 requires written consent prior to an autopsy not related to death requiring an investigation and specifies who may authorize that autopsy.
Close public hearing on Senate Bill 885 and reconvene the public hearing on Senate Bill 461 and ask our two folks to journey back up here again. I apologize. I meant for you just to stay here momentarily while we did this. Now, we have to be out of here by 3 o'clock for another committee, so...
Mr. Chair, just a question before you begin. Staff, I have a measure here, staff summary of 885, and it says the autopsy. Is that just a typo, or does that go in my 865 bill, or what?
There's an 865 and 885.
This is 885.
There's 865 and 885.
Requires consent prior to autopsy, not related to death request. So it's another autopsy bill.
No, 865 is not an autopsy bill.
865 is the third party payer bill.
Thank you.
Yep. Go ahead, ma'am. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
I think I'm going to go first. All right. Senator, if it's all right. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ralph Rizzuto. I'm a parent guardian, and I'm also president of ORVOR, Oregon Voice of the Retarded. I don't disagree with anything that's been said so far. I might have a different opinion as to some of the statements, but basically I want to say that I think the community facilities in many cases, at least from my experience, and especially when Fairview was still in session or still in operation, they used to tell us periodically that a community group home was coming through and they were going to select certain clients to move to their group home. But they were very selective. They told us that they'd look at all the personnel files and so on and so forth, and then they would take who they wanted to take. And they'd never really tell us the reasons for not taking the ones they didn't take, but it was always basically told that they were taking the ones that they felt they could take care of properly and not the more difficult type cases. My daughter has severe retardation and severe behavior problems, and she is in a SOCP. And I certainly have no disagreement that salaries and everything should be on an equal basis, but I don't believe that the community group homes, in many cases, have taken these kind of cases on. So I don't believe that parity is the same in that regard. The group homes, paying salaries that they are for people that basically were working at Fairview. They worked with these same people. My daughter, as an example, again, for many years, she'd been there for 20 years. And the people that were there know her conditions and know how severe her problems are. And she knows, and they know who she can get along with, and vice versa. I think it's very important that the people that are taking care of her know her idiosyncrasies and so on, and they know how to deal with them, and she gets along better with people that way. Whenever there's a turnover and she has to learn somebody new and they have to learn hers, for example, it's very frustrating for her. She has a lengthy period of time for adjustment and so on and so forth. And I think these people, not only my daughter, but all the mentally retarded people that have been there through birth, it's really, they've had a tough life to start with, and I don't think that we should every couple of years come up with some kind of a bill that's going to disrupt their care or their treatment that they're receiving. I think we've all lived a pretty good life regardless of our circumstances, but again, not just because she's my daughter, but anybody else is the same way, that I think their lives have been hard enough and we ought to take some care and compassionate treatment of them in that regard. But I am in favor of parity. If they are going to be given the same kind of treatment and they can treat them the same way and take care of them the same way, then they certainly should be paid the same way. But I'm not sure that's the whole basis of this debate today. Debate, if it, so be it. But basically, that's all I want to say, is that I think there is a need for parity, but I think it has to be based on maybe an individual basis. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you very much. Go ahead, ma'am.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Colleen Savage. I'm an AFSCME staff rep. I worked at Fairview, started in 1966, and I have worked with the staff and the clients since that time. In 1984, I went to work for AFSCME, so I have been with this group of folks for 37 years. I've been lucky in that I saw both sides. I was a manager at Fairview, and I was a union rep, and I was a floor staff at Fairview, and so when people talk to me about what are the problems out there, I really do understand. I lost my front teeth because of Fairview, and so when people talk about aggression, I know what that is. I worked in the medically fragile area at Fairview. I know what that is. I know what a trach is. I know what tube feeding is. We talked today, I heard a lot of people talk about the different levels of need that the populations need. I do know that we cost about $19,000 a month per client. But there are also clients out in the private sector that are receiving $14,000 a month who do not have staff who have been around the system for 8 years. That's where the money's going. We have a staff that are getting PERS. They're getting good wages, $13 an hour. We're getting health insurance for families. And so when you're looking at the costs, that's the stuff we have to look at the private sector also. I bargain contracts for both the state sector and the private sector MRDD staff. And, you know, those the people that I work with on both sides are really good folks. They're good providers. But what do you do when these workers come in at the age of 20 and leave at the age of 20 and a half, 21 and a half? They don't stay around long enough to build a career, so we have to enhance the reason for them to stay. And it's not always money. It's employee rights. It's I have a voice in the workplace. It doesn't mean that I'm unionized. It means I have a right to say something. We need to instill that in our employees in order to get them to stay in this field. It's a rough field to work in. I just would like to address the cuts that the state ops have made. I hate this budget thing that we're in right now, and we're all in it. But you know there's some good in it, because I, as the staff rep, have sat and watched the meetings that management has called with the floor staff, the support staff, the management staff, and then they called one with the union stewards and said, where do you see the waste? What do you see we're doing? Well, there's been some wonderful changes because of this. Through the budget process, we lost 3 crisis houses. They were not on board. They were scheduled to come on board. But we don't have those vacancies anymore. So for the public, they're gone. That was 15 beds. But the state ops have also reduced a house just in the last month. They've given it back. We're moving clients out because it was not cost effective. They have returned extra vehicles to the motor pool that we didn't need. I mean, and that's the kind of good stuff that comes out of this. So, you know, when I hear discussion about money, I just ask you to think about all the areas. It's not just wages. Well, I guess that's it. Thank you.
I would like to recommend that you and Ralph trade jobs.
No, thank you, Senator. She hammers me routinely.
So one promotion and one demotion or something?
more than one hazard of being up here in front, isn't it, Ralph?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Brennan.
Just a couple questions. Was your first name Colleen?
Yes.
Okay. Is it okay if I call you Colleen?
Yes.
Okay. As I pencil it out, $13 an hour is what, $520 a week, roughly? About $24,000 a year.
Yes.
So with benefits, health benefits and FERS, you're probably making, what, about $30,000 a year?
Yes. It's they're averaging that at 54% with time off, you know, sick leave, vacation leave. Yeah, the package is at 54%.
That's the average.
Okay. Can I ask a follow-up question, Mr. Chair?
Certainly.
I just wanted to get a sense of the workforce. My guess is a large portion of the workers are women. Is that correct, or is that not correct?
Senator Brown, I think we're right. We're probably 60-40.
Okay.
But we do have a lot of single parents, that kind of stuff.
So you have a lot of folks who have children.
Yes.
So raising either one or two children on $30,000 a year is pretty tough, isn't it?
Yes. We do overtime. We do. A person that I know works at Fred Meyer.
Okay. Thank you.
Two jobs.
Senator.
No, I don't.
My staff tells me that she thinks they've got a committee that's very interested in getting in this room.
So coming.
I appreciate everybody coming and appreciate the concerns that all of you have voiced.
Thank you.
And we'll try to figure out how to proceed on this. And we'll adjourn for the day.